eyebrows gathering together. He knows it's possible. He just doesn't want it to be. But I've told him what Trent and I have learned about the Tennessee Children's Home Society, and I can see that most of it wasn't new information to him or my mother. No doubt they've heard of the scandal, perhaps seen the TV shows that have reenacted events at Georgia's notorious children's home.
I can't. My mother?
Dad mutters.
Did my father know?
I don't think anyone knew. Grandma Judy and her sisters were grown women by the time they were reunited. May told me they didn't want to interfere with each other's lives. Considering that the paper trail was set up to keep birth families from finding one another, it's a miracle that even four of the siblings were brought back together.
My God.
He shakes his head as if he's trying to rearrange the thoughts there, to put them in some workable order.
My mother has a twin?
She was born a twin. She did search over the years, but she was never able to find out what happened after that. Whether her twin died or survived and was adopted. My father rests his chin on his hands. He looks upward through the trees.
My dear God in heaven.
I know what he's thinking. I've been turning the same things over in my mind since the day I learned the truth. All week long, I've gone back and forth between taking the secret to the grave with me and setting the truth free, come what may. In the end, it boils down to this. My father deserves to know who he is. My grandmother deserves whatever time she has left to spend with her sister. The five little river gypsies who suffered at the hands of the Tennessee Children's Home Society deserve to have their stories carried forward into the future. But for a strange twist of fate, my father's mother would have grown up on a riverboat, among common folk, surrounded by the poverty of the Great Depression. She wouldn't have been of the class to have met my grandfather, much less married him. We wouldn't be Staffords. My mother regains herself a bit, lifts her chin, and reaches across to unfasten my father's hands and hold one of them.
It's ancient history. There's no sense in agonizing over it now, Wells. There's no reason to be bringing it up at all.
A glance slides my way. A warning. I resist the urge to wilt. For me, there's no turning back. Dad, what you decide to do from here is your choice. All I ask is that Grandma Judy be able to have time with her sister, for however long they have left. They've spent their whole lives hiding away from the world, for our benefit. They deserve to be at peace now. My father kisses my mother's fingers, folds them between his, and nods. Silently, he's telling both of us he'll mull this over and make his own decisions. Honeybee leans closer to me.
What about this, the man in there? Can he be trusted not to, well, to use this information? With the Senate run coming up next year, there's nothing Cal Fortner would like more than a personal scandal to distract from the issues.
I'm relieved when she automatically looks to my father, not me, in regard to the next Senate race. I feel life shifting toward its old balance, and I'm glad. It'll be easier to tell them there won't be a politically advantageous wedding in our garden during azalea season. I'm not ready to broach the subject yet, but I will. Being here, seeing May and my grandmother together, makes me all the more certain of it. All the more certain of myself. You don't have to worry about Trent. He wouldn't do that. He's a friend. If it weren't for his grandfather, Grandma Judy's sisters never would have found her. She wouldn't have learned the truth about her past. My mother's expression indicates that she's unconvinced it wouldn't have been better that way. My father's face says otherwise.
I'd like to talk to Mrs. Crandall a bit.
Honeybee's mouth falls open a little. Then she pops it shut, straightens herself, and nods in acquiescence. Whatever path my father chooses, she will walk it right beside him. This is how my parents have always been. I think May would welcome that. We can leave the four of you alone so she can tell you her story. Hearing it from May, in her own words, will bring it home to my father, I hope. This is our family history.
You can stay, my mother says uncertainly.
I'd rather just let you have a bit of time. Really? I want to be alone with Trent. I know he's dying to ask how my parents took the news about Grandma Judy. He keeps looking at me through the cottage window. He's obviously relieved when we stand and cross to the door. Inside, my grandmother is talking about a boating trip down the river. She speaks of it as if it happened yesterday. Apparently, May bought a John boat at one time. Grandma Judy is laughing about the four of them floating off down the Savannah River when the motor wouldn't start. My father moves tentatively to a chair, looks at his mother as if he's never seen her before. In a way, he hasn't. The woman he remembers was an actress playing a role, at least partially. For all the years since her sisters found her, there have been two people inside the body of Judy Stafford. One of them is a senator's wife. The other carries the blood of river gypsies. In this little cottage, on yet another sister's day, the two meld into one. Trent is more than happy to vacate the premises with me. Let's walk up the hill, I suggest. I wanted to grab a few pictures of the plantation house ruins, just in case this whole thing falls apart and we never come back here again. Trent smiles as we pass through the gate and leave the cottage gardens behind.
I don't think it will.
We walk the path to the edge of the trees. I think of Rill Foss becoming May Weathers all those years ago. Could she ever have imagined the life she would live? The sunlight warms me as we cross into the open field and start up the hill. It's a beautiful day, one that hints at the upcoming change of the seasons. The shadow of the mansion's ancient remains falls on the grass, making the towering structure seem solid again. My hands shake as I take out my phone and snap photos. This isn't really why I wanted to come here. There was a reason I felt the need to move out of sight of the cottage. And out of earshot. Now I can't find the words. Or the courage. Instead, I take a ridiculous number of pictures. Eventually, my ruse runs out. I swallow a sudden onslaught of butterflies, try to muster up the necessary fortitude. Trent beats me to it.
You're not wearing the ring,
he observes, his eyes filling with questions when I turn to him. I look down at my hand, think about all that I've learned since I accepted Elliot's proposal, then moved back to South Carolina to do what was expected. That feels like a different life. The music of a different woman. Elliot and I talked. He doesn't agree with my decisions about Grandma Judy and May, and he probably never will. But it's more than that. I think we've both known for a while now that we're better as friends than as a couple. We have years of history between us, a lot of fond memories,
but there's just something missing. I think that's why we've avoided setting a date or making firm plans. The wedding was more about our families than it was about us. Maybe in some way, we've known that all along. I watch Trent as he studies our shadows on the grass, frowning contemplatively. My heart flutters, then pounds. The seconds seem like taffy, sticky, and slow-moving. Does Trent feel the way I do? What if he doesn't? He has a young son to consider, for one thing. I don't know exactly where I'm going in life, for another. Working with the pack will give me time to find out who I want to be. I like setting things right that were wrong. I think that's why I've dug so deeply into May's story, why I've brought my grandmother and May here this afternoon. An old wrong has been set right today, inasmuch as is possible all these years later. There's a sense of satisfaction in that. But now the questions about Trent eclipse it. How does he fit into the future I've only begun to imagine? His family and mine are so different. His eyes catch the light when he looks back at me. They're the blue of deep water. And for the first time, I realize that perhaps we're not as different as we seem. We share a rich heritage. We're both descended from the river.
Does this mean I can hold your hand?
He smiles along with the words, raises an eyebrow, and waits. Yes, I think it does. He turns his palm up, and I put my hand in it. His fingers close over mine, a warm, strong circle. And we walk up the hill away from the ruins of a life that was, and into a life that can be.
Chapter 26. May Crandall. Present day. Our story begins on a sweltering August night, in a sterile white room, where a single fateful decision is made amid the mindless ravages of grief. But our story does not end there. It has not ended yet. Would I change the course of our lives if I could? Would I have spent my years plucking out tunes on a showboat, or turning the soil as a farmer's wife, or waiting for a riverman to come home from work and settle in beside me at a cozy little fire? Would I trade the son I bore for a different son, for more children, for a daughter to comfort me in my old age? Would I give up the husbands I loved and buried, the music, the symphonies, the lights of Hollywood, the grandchildren and great-grandchildren who live far distant but have my eyes? I ponder this as I sit on the wooden bench, Judy's hand in mine, the two of us quietly sharing yet another sister's day, here in the gardens at Magnolia Manor. We're able to have sister's day anytime we like. It is as easy as leaving my room and walking to the next hall and telling the attendant, "I believe I'll take my dear friend Judy out for a little stroll." "Oh, yes, of course, I'll be certain she's delivered safely back to the memory care unit. You know I always do." Sometimes my sister and I laugh over our clever ruse. We're really sisters, not friends, I remind her. But don't tell them. It's our secret. I won't tell, she smiles in her sweet way. But sisters are friends as well. Sisters are special friends. We recall our many Sisters' Day adventures from years past, and she begs me to share what I remember of Queenie and Briny and our life on the river. I tell her of days and seasons with Camellia and Lark and Fern and Gabian and Silas and old Zeed. I speak of quiet backwaters and rushing currents, the midsummer ballet of dragonflies, and winter ice floes that allowed men to walk over water. Together, we travel the living river. We turn our faces to the sunlight and fly time and time again home to Kingdom Arcadia. Other days, my sister knows me not at all, other than as a neighbor here in this old manor house. But the love of sisters needs no words. It does not depend on memories, or mementos, or proof. It runs as deep as a heartbeat. It is as ever-present as a pulse. Aren't they so very sweet? Judy points to the young couple strolling the garden paths near Manor Lake, hand in hand. They make a lovely picture together. I pat Judy's arm gently. That is your granddaughter. I imagine she's come here to visit with you. And she's brought her beau along. He's a looker, that one. I told her the first time I saw them together, he was a keeper. I recognize a spark when I see it. Oh, of course, my granddaughter. Judy pretends to have known it all along. Some days she would have, but not on this particular day. And her beau? She squints toward the garden path. I'm having trouble calling up the names just now. My silly mind, you know. Avery. Oh, yes, Avery. And Trent. We knew a Trent Turner once, didn't we? He was a dear man. He sold the cottage lots adjacent to the Edisto place, I think. Yes, he did. That is his grandson coming up the walk with Avery. Well, do tell. Judy waves enthusiastically, and Avery waves in response. Then she and her beau disappear momentarily behind the arbor. They don't come out as quickly as they might. Judy presses a hand over her mouth, chuckling. Oh, my. Indeed. I remember lost loves and loves that never were. We Fosses have always been an impassioned lot. I don't suppose that will ever change. I don't believe it ever should, Judy agrees. And we fall together in the sweet embrace of sisters, laughing at our own secrets.
A note from the author. As you close these pages, perhaps you're wondering, how much of this story is true? That question is, in some ways, difficult to answer. If you'd like to dig more deeply into the real-life history of baby farms, orphanages, changes in adoption, Georgia Tan, and the scandal surrounding the Tennessee Children's Home Society in Memphis, you'll find excellent information in Pricing the Priceless Child, The Changing Social Value of Children by Viviana A. Zelizer, 1985, Babies for Sale, The Tennessee Children's Home Adoption Scandal by Linda Tollett Austin, 1993, Alone in the World,
Orphans and Orphanages in America by Catherine Reif, 2005, and The Baby Thief, The Untold Story of Georgia Tan, The Baby Seller Who Corrupted Adoption by Barbara Byzance Raymond, 2007, which also contains interviews with several of Georgia Tan's victims. For a view of the scandal as it broke, see the original Report to Governor Gordon Browning on Shelby County Branch, Tennessee Children's Home Society, 1951, which is available through the public library system. There are also many newspaper and magazine articles available about the scandal as it happened and about the reunions of birth families in later years, as well as coverage in episodes of 60 Minutes, Unsolved Mysteries, and Investigation Discovery's Deadly Women. All of these sources were invaluable to me as research materials. The Voss children and the Arcadia were formed from the dust of imagination and the muddy waters of the Mississippi River. Though Rill and her siblings exist only in these pages, their experiences mirror those reported by children who were taken from their families from the 1920s through 1950. The true story of Georgia Tan and the Memphis branch of the Tennessee Children's Home Society is a bizarre and sad paradox. There is little doubt that the organization rescued many children from deplorable, dangerous circumstances, or simply accepted children who were unwanted and placed them in loving homes. There is also little doubt that countless children were taken from loving parents without cause or due process and never seen again by their desperately grieving biological families. Survivor accounts bear out that empty-armed birth mothers pined for their missing children for decades, and that many of those children were placed in holding facilities where they were neglected, molested, abused, and treated as objects. Single mothers, indigent parents, women in mental wards, and those seeking help through welfare services and maternity clinics were particular targets. Birth mothers were duped into signing paperwork while under postpartum sedation, were told that turning over temporary custody was necessary to secure medical treatment for their children, or were often simply informed that their babies had died. Children who lived through stints in the home's custody, those who were old enough to have memories of their prior lives, reported having been whisked from front porches, from roadsides while walking to school, and yes, from houseboats on the river. Essentially, if you were poor and you lived, stayed, or stopped over in the proximity of Memphis, your children were at risk. Blondes like the Foss siblings were particularly popular in Georgia Tan's system and were often targeted by spotters who worked in medical facilities and public aid clinics. Average residents of the city, while unaware of her methods, were not unaware of her work. For years, citizens watched for newspaper advertisements bearing photos of adorable babies and children, underscored by captions like, "Yours for the asking," "Want a real live Christmas present?" and "George wants to play catch, but he needs a daddy." Georgia Tan was heralded as the mother of modern adoption and was even consulted by Eleanor Roosevelt on matters of child welfare. To the general public, Tan was simply a matronly, well-meaning woman who devoted her life to rescuing children in need. Her celebration of children adopted by wealthy, well-known families helped to popularize the idea of adoption in general and dispel the widespread belief that orphaned children were undesirable and inherently damaged. Georgia's high-profile list included political figures such as New York Governor Herbert Lehman and Hollywood celebrities such as Joan Crawford and June Allison and her husband Dick Powell. Former staff members of Tan's orphanage in Memphis whispered of as many as 7 babies at a time being spirited away under cover of darkness for transportation to foster homes in California, New York, and other states. In reality, these children were often being shipped off to profitable out-of-state adoptions in which Tan pocketed the lion's share of the exorbitant delivery fees. When interviewed about her methods, Georgia unabashedly extolled the virtues of removing children from lowly parents who could not possibly raise them properly and placing them with people of high type. From a modern perspective, it's hard to imagine how Georgia Tan and her network managed to operate largely unchecked for decades, or where she found workers willing to turn a blind eye to the inhumane treatment of children in the organization's group homes and in unlicensed boarding facilities, like the one where Rill and her siblings land. Yet it happened. At one point, the U.S. Children's Bureau sent an investigator to Memphis to probe the city's soaring infant mortality rate. In a 4-month period in 1945, a dysentery epidemic had caused the deaths of 40 to 50 children under the care of Georgia's facility, despite the efforts of a doctor who volunteered medical services there. Georgia, however, insisted that only 2 children had been lost. Under pressure, the state legislature passed a law mandating the licensing of every children's boarding home in Tennessee. The newly passed legislation included a subsection providing an exemption for all boarding homes employed by Georgia Tan's agency. While Mrs. Murphy and her home in the story are fictional, Rill's experiences there were inspired by those reported by survivors. There were also many who, due to abuse, neglect, illness, or inadequate medical attention, did not live to tell their stories. They are the silent victims of an unregulated system fueled by greed and financial opportunity. Estimates as to the number of children who have simply vanished under Georgia Tan's management range as high as 500. Thousands more disappeared into adoptions for profit in which names, birth dates, and birth records were altered to prevent biological families from finding their children. One would assume, given these awful statistics, that Georgia Tan's reign would have eventually ended amid a firestorm of public revelations, police inquiries, and legal action. If Before We Were Yours were entirely fictional, that's how I would have written its end, with scenes of swift and certain justice. Sadly, this was not the case. Georgia's many years in the adoption business did not draw to a close until 1950. At a press conference that September, Governor Gordon Browning skirted the heartbreaking human tragedy of it all and instead discussed the money. Miss Tan, he reported, had benefited illegally to the tune of $1 million, equivalent to roughly $10 million today, while employed by the Tennessee Children's Home Society. Despite the revelation of her crimes, Tan was, by then, beyond the reach of legal action. Within days of the press conference, she succumbed to uterine cancer and died at home in her own bed. A newspaper exposé ran opposite her obituary on the front page of the local paper. Her children's home was closed and an investigator appointed, but he soon found himself stymied by powerful people with secrets, reputations, and, in some cases, adoptions to preserve. While the closing of the home gave grieving birth families reason to hope, that hope was quickly snatched from them. Legislators and political power brokers passed laws legalizing even the most questionable of her adoptions and sealing the records. Of the 22 wards remaining in Tan's care at the time of her death, only 2, who had already been rejected by their adopted families, were returned to their birth parents. Thousands of birth families would never know what became of their children. The general public sentiment was that, having been given over from poverty to privilege, the children were better off where they were, no matter the circumstances of their adoptions. While some adoptees, separated siblings, and birth families were able to find one another through pieced-together memories, documents spirited from courthouse files, and the assistance of private investigators, Georgia Tan's records would not finally be opened to her victims until 1995. For many birth parents and adoptees, who grieved their losses throughout their lifetimes, that was simply too late. For others, it was the beginning of long-delayed family reunions and the opportunity to finally tell their own stories. If there is one overarching lesson to be learned from the Foss children and from the true life story of the Tennessee Children's Home Society, it is that babies and children, no matter what corner of the world they hail from, are not commodities or objects or blank slates, as Georgia Tan so often represented her wards. They are human beings with histories and needs and hopes and dreams of their own. This is Emily Rankin. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Before We Were Yours by Lisa Wingate. This program was directed by Arthur G. Insana. Executive producer, Aaron Blank. Text copyright 2017 by Wingate Media, LLC. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.